Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
I'm speaking with Mark Derry. He's an author of several recent volumes of culture criticism of cyberculture. The 1993 volume Culture Jamming, 1996 volume Escape Velocity, and an upcoming volume of essays based on a metaphor of Coney Island that he'll be describing called The Pyrotechnic and Sanitarium, as well as many essays on fringe culture, technology, mass media, and the arts for a diverse collection of journals, including The New York Times, Rolling Stone, Wired, 21st Century, Mondo 2000, Elle, New York, The Village Voice. Welcome, Mr. Derry.
Welcome. Great to be with you. Let me just add one little footnote to the curriculum vitae you just reeled off. I also edited the 1995 anthology Flame Wars, The Discourse of Cyberculture, which might be of interest to some of your readers. It's a collection of essays on fringe computer culture and the politics of high technology.
And you have an essay in there on Black to the Future.
Right, and that's about something that I theorize under the name of Afrofuturism. And essentially, I grapple with the question of why so few African-American authors write science fiction. And I tunnel into that in my introductory essay, and then I climb into the ring with Samuel Delaney, visionary SF author, Greg Tate, noted Afrocentrist cultural critic, and Tricia Rose, who wrote a marvelous book called Black Noise about the subcultural politics of hip-hop.
Now, the bulk of your work has been focused on questions of cyber escapism and the ways in which the emerging culture is moving away from engagement with real concerns of the day. Mm-hmm. Can you describe some of those issues that you're concerned about?
Well, that's a sweepingly expansive question. Let me try to iris down the aperture just a little bit. I mean, one of the emergent theses of escape velocity, to use the chaos theory and artificial life lingo of the day, one of the emergent theses is the notion that the mind-body split, which has bedeviled Western ontology since at least the Enlightenment and certainly since Descartes, is exacerbated by everyday reality late in the 20th century, that more and more we are immersed head first in terminal landscapes on the other side of the screen, that a lot of the flagship technologies of our historical moment are discorporating technologies. That is to say, more and more we wander wraith-like as disembodied infomorphs through the sort of luminous, numinous other worlds of the net and virtual reality, computer games, as well as more banal examples like television and Hollywood blockbusters. And meanwhile, our bodies are slumped in our ergonomic workstations over the keyboard, you know, like some sort of jettison third stage of the rocket. McLuhan predicted a lot of this when he talked about discarnate man, one of his favorite tropes. And he suggested that electronic technologies are overwhelmingly technologies of disembodiment, that they exacerbate the discorporation that has been kind of a salient feature of Western technological progress for quite some long while.
And part of this is also the fixation that people have on gadgets and computers and new toys that they think are going to fix our problems. This is a pretty long tradition in American culture, isn't it?
Right, and it's uniquely American, too. I mean, there are a few things to say about this, which is that the discourse that echoes through the pages of Wired, this sort of luminous, Jetsonian, Nicholas Negroponte vision of a future of infinite bandwidth, talking commodities in which our toasters brand the day's stock, you know, Dow Jones index on our toast as it pops out, and the Daily Me, an electronic newspaper that is kind of a monument to solipsism, is spat out on our laptops at the breakfast table. I mean, all all these visions that are percolating up in Wired magazine and out of the mouths of bearded prophets of New Age cyber hype like John Perry Barlow are very, very American, and they intertwine with a series of kind of historical narratives and bedtime stories we as Americans like to tell ourselves about the world around us. So it isn't just capitalist fairy tales about technological progress that are characterized by notions of infinite expansion, inexhaustible resources, nature as raw fodder for the engines of capitalism. But there's also the Judeo-Christian tradition, which is kind of plagued by a latent Gnosticism that is never really shaken off. Catholicism even more dramatically exemplifies this. And it tends to demonize the body and devalue the material world, the mundane world, as religious mystics refer to it. So there's this emphasis on the there and then and not on the here and now. And you can really see this in spades in right-wing religious fundamentalists, or not even right-wing, simply, evangelical Christians whose cars bear the bumper sticker, in case of rapture, car will be driverless. You know, there's this sense that we're going to be plucked out of the sticky mess of matter and into this luminous other world and given new bodies. We'll be gathered up into the folds of, you know, the revenant Christ's robe as he returns at the end of the age, and all the true believers, you know, in chick comic books and all the kind of sub-legitimate ephemeral literature of fundamentalist Christianity, you know, depict believers literally sort of lifted out of their underwear and into Christ's arms and given new eternal, you know, sort of stainless bodies. And this discourse dovetails seamlessly with the extropian and technophilic fantasies of people like Hans Moravec, which are all about body loathing and exfoliating the too solid flesh and reincarnating ourselves in sublime other worlds of pure simulation and information. I mean, not for nothing does Frank Tipler, the physicist, write a book called The Physics of Immortality, which rationalizes Judeo-Christian notions of heaven in strictly empirical terms, extrapolated from fringe physics. So those three discourses, the Judeo-Christian tradition in America, American obsession with, you know, gadget pornography, and capitalist narratives of progress all come to ground in the kind of giddy rhapsodies of the digerati late in the 20th century. And then also there's perhaps a fourth historical thread, which is the notion of America as a new Jerusalem. John Winthrop's bright and shining city, build it upon a hill. The notion that America is utopia's natural home, that in some way it is a kind of a literalization of the Revelation's vision of Jerusalem come down to earth.
My favorite rapture bumper sticker is, in case of rapture, going to have your car. But it seems like a lot of these trends came together with the suicide cult out in California when they believed in flying saucers. And there was just a very minor bit of popular commentary that noted that the belief that the body was profane and that there was a better life after death was actually the staple of all Judeo-Christian religion and not at all an aberration.
Right. There's actually a hilarious, mordantly funny column written by the left-wing and unrepentantly atheistic cultural critic, or perhaps agnostic would be a better term, Katha Paulett in The Nation, in which she said, "I'm still having trouble with this cult-religion distinction." I mean, one of the most fascinating aspects of the kind of media spin control and damage containment efforts in the wake of the Heaven Gate suicides was this immediate attempt to police the borderland between legitimate and sublegitimate, between the discourses of dominant culture and the, you know, cult cyberbabble of fringe culture. So time and time again, you see in evening news reports and newspaper op-eds, this paranoid, hysterical attempt to distance, you know, real, legitimate religions, and I say that very much in quotes, from cults, and cults are demonized as pathological, suicidal. And as Paulet rightly points out, I mean, don't belief systems like the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Christian Scientists, you know, whose teachings forbid blood transfusions and that sort of thing, don't they legitimately earn the term suicidal in some very real sense of the word? And similarly, you know, if sheer crackpotism is some sort of dipstick indicator of fringe or cult mentality, what could be more patently absurd than the notion of transubstantiation, the Catholic doctrine that, you know, when the priest blesses the wafer, it is magically transmuted into the flesh of a 2,000-year-old dead Jew? I mean, this is pretty much the limit case for human credulity in my book. You know, but I am obviously, as you can tell, a conscientious objector in a country that reeks to heaven of religion. Yeah. You know, doubtless you'll be firebombed minutes after you air this interview.
Well, we're here in the... No, I don't think so. We're here in a bastion of Yankee rugged individualism. A lot of the folks around here are pretty... Influenced by their Puritan past, though, I have to acknowledge that.
Yes, well, we should bear in mind that New England was also the cradle of Cotton Mather.
Exactly. I wanted to turn, I fully endorse your religious reservations. I was raised a Unitarian myself, and then
How interesting.
Took a turn towards Buddhism, but find a lot of the mystical and superstitious aspects of Buddhism problematic. So.
Right.
I guess I kind of straddle the fence occasionally because of that, because I have a strong grounding in anti-clericism and rationalism from the Unitarian tradition, and then some inkling of a desire for transcendence on the other hand, which I admit to being occasionally seduced by all of the fantasies that you're describing. Perhaps,
right.
Perhaps not the Americas, the New Jerusalem. That one was always foreign to me. I think I saw Sweden as the New Jerusalem. Now, you've also written about, in Escape Philosophy, which is the book that really brought me to your attention, you've written about many of the different cultural trends, and I wanted to have you dilate on a couple of them. One was the kind of transmutation of cyberpunk as an idea in our culture. What was cyberpunk all about?
You mean retrospectively, historically?
Well, is it still something that's out there, or is cyberpunk dead?
Well, I think it's effectively dead. I mean, it's taken its place in the mental strip mall, you know, as part of the pantheon of available styles for American vernacular culture, a sure sign that it has lost its bite as a subcultural ritual of resistance. I mean, when the host of the dating game starts wearing a Nehru jacket, you know that hippie is over. And similarly with cyberpunk, I think its epitaph was carved by the Billy Idol record of the same name, if not earlier. Probably it was already consigned to the desktop recycle bin of history right about the time that Time magazine, under the watchful eye, I guess, of Philip Elmer DeWitt, did its cover story on cyberpunk. And there's a neat historical parallelism there. The Time magazine cover story on hippie, I think in either 67 or 68, is now seen retrospectively as the epitaph for the counterculture, as the moment when the counterculture, had been flayed and turned into an off-the-rack statement of lockstep nonconformity. There was a brief period of happy virulence where cyberpunk represented some kind of subcultural statement. I was most interested in it in Escape Velocity, not because of its sort of techno-weeny, white boy braggadocio, but rather as an example of technological bricolage. I mean, the locus classicus of cyberpunk myth is the Gibsonian refrain, "The street finds its own uses for things," which ribbons its way through a number of Gibson's novels, novellas, and short stories. I mean, he repeats it at least three or four times throughout his writings. And that's a fascinating notion, because that is kind of inherently political. It's a sort of a libertarian politic, but it's also kind of a technological techno-primitive, Mad Max, Road Warrior, post-apocalyptic politic. And essentially it turns on the notion of the perverse and sometimes subversive appropriation, refunctioning, and misuse of the cast-off technological oddments of dominant culture. And that's an idea that's enormously appealing to postmodern lefties like me. And it needn't be taken literally. I mean, just as Mark Pauline of Survival Research Laboratories retrofits and refunctions the discarded detritus of the aeronautics industry in California and the computer industry in Silicon Valley, so too are technological, or rather textual bricoleurs, so-called textual poachers, like the Midwestern housewives who rewrite Star Trek narratives to wildly pornographic effect. I mean, that too is an example of the street finding its own uses for things. And I get sort of a perverse bang out of that kind of thing. And it really relates to what the Russian social theorist Mikhail Bakhtin was talking about in his book about Rabelais, called Rabelais and His World. It's the notion of the carnivalesque. In medieval carnival, the world is turned upside down, social mores are briefly suspended, and emblems of dominant culture are literally inverted or reversed as a sort of a way of thumbing one's nose at the status quo. And that sort of symbolically acted out in cyberpunk.
But your emphasis seems to be on the way in which these symbolic forms of resistance, rebellion, or de terre mort, as the situationists used to call it, are reincorporated into the spectacle, that things serve to prop up consumer capitalism at the same time that they represent some kind of rebellion against it.
Well, I'm not all that Frankfurtian in the sense of the Frankfurt Marxist. I mean, that's the moral of the story told by Horkheimer and Adorno in their essay, The Culture Industry. I don't follow that trajectory. I think that happens, but I think simultaneously there is a willful and perverse form of kind of consumerized or consumerist resistance happening underneath the floorboards. In other words, what you say is absolutely true. That is a point I make in my writings, that at a historical moment when all political options have been effectively foreclosed by the juggernaut of transnational global capitalism, where the left is en route and seen as conceptually bankrupt, even as obviously neoliberalism, that is to say radical laissez-faire capitalism associated with the Chicago School, is even as we speak perpetrating a global disaster, even so, there's a feeling that there's nothing but the marketplace. So people construct their visions of utopian alternatives and their notions of resistance, even symbolic resistance, or what I've called sort of guerrilla semiotics, semiological guerrilla warfare. They construct those visions and those practices out of the fragments of consumer culture. So there's this sense that one is rebelling by sort of retrofitting and refunctioning things like Star Trek narratives and the logos, icons, glyphs, and colophons of corporate monsters. I mean, for example, there's a marvelous lesbian t-shirt that says Dyke in the exact same lettering as the Nike emblem, and is accompanied by kind of a swoosh. And this kind of thing proliferates in subcultures all over America and all over the globe. So on the one hand, you have the marketplace logic that Tom Frank talks about in his book, Commodify Your Rebellion, where every subcultural gesture of resistance is almost immediately strip-mauled and transformed into off-the-rack mass fashion in America. I mean, consumer capital is brilliant in its metastasization of rebellion, of subcultural rebellion. It simply co-opts it, makes it painfully unhip. At the same time, subcultural rebellion is always a step ahead, constantly retrofitting and refunctioning these emblems of dominant culture into glyphs and brands of resistance and rebellion. But it all happens within the circumscribed compass of the marketplace and consumer culture, because at this moment in time, overwhelmingly, there's the feeling that that's all there is. I mean, what are you going to do? You know, the alternative is the Unabomber.
We have about 2 minutes left. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Pyrotechnic and Sanitarium?
Well, the Pyrotechnic and Sanitarium is a collection of essays on Fandomillennium America as a kind of pathological carnival midway, as, you know, the carnival scene in Strangers on a Train by Hitchcock, kind of gene-spliced with Fox tabloid news. It's a meditation on, you know, the madness of crowds in an age of amok media, as well as private pathologies and subcultural sort of micro-trends. And I refract a lot of the kind of dominant cultural dynamics of our moment through crystalline specific examples. So I look at body loathing as exemplified in the Learning Channel show The Operation, which televises live what I call in-your-face lifts, as well as breast reconstruction, everything from brain surgery to bunion removal.
And medical pornography.
Exactly. And I look at it as both a kind of a pressure gauge for a recoil from the flesh as putrescent and loathsome, as well as a renewed fascination with the body, even as it recedes in the rearview mirror of the digital age. And then there are a lot of other essays in there in which I pick apart popular culture. Jim Carrey's Talking Anus. I mean, how a man who is best known for ventriloquizing his butt came to be the family-friendly face of fun late in the 20th century. I consider that passing strange, and I look at him as the latest incarnation of the French cabaret performer Le Petomane, fetishized by Frank Zappa and William Burroughs, a man who could literally make his anus sing. And there are a whole series of essays like that in which I essentially grapple with the notion that we are losing our gyre, that we have spun off our axis, and I look at that as both true and untrue, as kind of amplified by the echo chamber of the media, and yet also a function of the kind of voodoo numerology of millennial dread.
I want to highly recommend your work. Your commentary on performance art, music, drugs, philosophy, politics in your work is so dense and rich with interpretation. It's just great.
Well, that's really flattering. I appreciate that.
And you can find out more about Mark Derry's work at www.well.com/user/MarkDerry, D-E-R-Y / And you have links there to various parts of your work.
I do indeed, and I would also encourage any listeners, you know, who want to run me to ground on any of these ideas to shoot me some email. I'm on the well, markdeary@well.com.
Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.